This is Bill Newman, WHMP.
We are really lucky to have in the valley in the last day or two Arun Kundani. He is at Hampshire College today at Franklin Patterson Hall at noon. He was speaking at UMass last night at the campus center. Arun Kundani is a professor of media, culture, and communications at New York University. He teaches terrorism studies at John Jay College. Is it John Jay College for Criminal Justice or John Jay College?
Criminal Justice, yeah.
And he has been a visiting fellow at many universities around the world as the editor of the journal Race and Class. His new book is The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terrorism. Really pleased to have him with us today. Really pleased that he's come to the Valley to give these talks at Hampshire and UMass. And I was struck today, front page of the business page of the New York Times, business British spies said to intercept Yahoo webcam images. Listen to this. A British intelligence agency collected video webcam images, many of them sexually explicit, from millions of Yahoo users, regardless of whether they were suspected of illegal activity, according to documents leaked by Edward Snowden. The surveillance effort operated by the British government has been shared, it seems, with the United States government as well. It's unclear how much data was shared with the Americans, but it seems to be a lot. And these webcam images seem to have an enormous amount of information and data, all of which is collected, I know everyone will be shocked to hear this, without a warrant. So, Arun Kundani, you speak in your book, The Muslims Are Coming, at quite some length about the surveillance state and its relationship to the surveillance of Muslims. Is this part of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, all the revelations that we've had from Edward Snowden, this is another piece from the whistleblowing of Edward Snowden.
And this appeared in The Guardian before it appeared in The Times?
It's originally reported yesterday in The Guardian. Spencer Ackerman for The Guardian had this yesterday there. So all of these kind of revelations from Edward Snowden have been obviously incredibly important in totally transforming how we think about these issues around privacy and civil liberties. The interesting thing about this story is this kind of division of labor across the Atlantic, right? So that because Britain has a slightly different legislative framework around this stuff, it means that the NSA can outsource to the British spies to spy on Americans, and the British spies can outsource to the NSA to spy on the British. And on each side of the Atlantic, that way you can get around the what would otherwise be the legal restrictions.
Why, if the primary focus of the surveillance is supposed to be Muslims and Islamists, which we'll talk about in just a moment, why does this spread to the entire culture? Why is the government spying on everyone?
Well, you know, I don't, you know, when you listen to the kind of defense that the government comes out with, they say, you know, the majority of the population doesn't need to worry because we only focus on the bad guys, right? And
But they tend to think we're all bad.
Right, exactly. So in practice, everyone is being spied on, or at least to the extent that all of us are having our data collected by the government in huge ways. You know, at the moment, the way that we've been getting information from Edward Snowden is we're getting a lot of information about what's being collected. We don't really know very much about how that data is used, how it's analyzed. The work I've been doing around looking at how the FBI does surveillance suggests to me that actually the focus is very much on dissidents, on political activists, on Muslims, and while data is being collected on all of us, where it actually gets used is actually much more focused, but not on the bad guys, but on people who are either minorities or political activists.
Do you think that this characterization of America, and I suspect Great Britain as well, I'd like to know if you think there's a difference, as a surveillance state is accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is accurate. You know, I think one of the problems we have is that when we think about a surveillance state, the kind of images in our head that we reach for are, you know, the Orwell 1984, various other kind of images from history or from fiction that that
I've said that Orwell's main problem looking back is he suffered from a failure of imagination.
Right. You know, what all of those images have in common is that they picture a totalitarian state where you have a narrow elite and that elite is in control of the whole population, right? I think what we have is not exactly that. What we have is a system where you have for the majority the kind of trappings of some kind of democratic process, but then for these kind of marginalized groups, Muslims in particular, you have something where all the normal kind of liberal principles go out the window, right? And so it's that dichotomy between the majority and the minority that these images from Orwell and from, you know, the kind of Cold War image of totalitarianism doesn't really capture.
Arun Kundani, I have to say that one part of your book, The Muslims Are Coming, struck me as being really prescient and insightful, and something I hadn't thought about, which had to do with a political consensus or something close to it. And you say this, you say, two main modes of thinking pervade the war on terror, one predominantly among conservatives, one among liberals. The first mode, the conservative view, locates the origins of terrorism in what is regarded as Islamic culture's failure to adapt to modernity. And the second, the liberal view, traces the roots of terrorism not in Islam itself, but in a series of 20th century ideologues who distorted the religion to produce the totalitarian ideology, Islamism, on the models of communism and fascism, in which you say, in essence, well, you know, the part of the problem with fighting back against this surveillance state is that there is in large measure, or has been in large measure, a political consensus that it's okay to target Muslims.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think we have become familiar, you know, over the last decade with the kind of flaws in the kind of neoconservative view of what the war on terror should look like.
But you also say the liberal view, right, is almost as bad.
Right, absolutely. And what I think where we have to do some work is actually examining the kind of liberal take on this, which is you know, much less often discussed, and obviously nowadays is what defines the Obama administration approach to this, right? So that's been the kind of way in which this stuff has been legitimized.
Now, you describe the terrorist violence, or more specifically, the threat of terrorist violence in the United States as largely imagined. I think a lot of listeners would say, okay, it's largely imagined, but, or at least it's largely hyped to be a presence and a threat that doesn't exist. But that said, there was 9/11. It did happen. There are terrorists who would like to take down and inflict great damage on the United States. How much of that is real?
Right. I mean, so the first thing to think about is, you know, the huge, we're spending billions of dollars every year on just on the domestic threat, firstly, right? So, fine, you know, there is clearly some people out there in the world who want to inflict violence on American civilians within the United States.
Yeah, and about spending the billions in the United States internally, I love the part when Homeland Security had these billions and billions of dollars to spend. They needed to hire people to do the work, and so they hired thousands and thousands and thousands of people who only speak English.
Right, absolutely. You know, but if you're thinking about the American Muslim population, right, I think, you know, if you actually look at the statistics on this, you'd be amazed at how little of a threat you can find, even if you try really hard here, right? Out of all of the terrorist prosecutions that have taken place, with the exception of a tiny handful, they are the result of entrapment operations by the FBI. So the actual people that are getting convicted would never have been terrorists if it wasn't for the FBI doing a sting operation. It's the only radicalization taking place here is the FBI's. You know, what happens when you kind of have this huge focus on this one group is you ignore the fact that you know, there's also far right groups that are out there who seem to have actually gone a lot further in terms of presenting a threat. And there's you know, we have 15,000 people killed every year in murders in America, and we don't really do very much about that compared to the amount of resources we put into this kind of constructed and imagined threat of terrorism.
You write this. You say, today, despite the working class black and Arab origins of American Islam, the mean family income of Muslims in the United States is roughly similar to that of the population as a whole. For every cab driver, cleaner, or unemployed refugee, there is a doctor or engineer living in the suburbs. Is this picture of Muslims in America been so distorted, in your judgment, by American media and American politicians trying to exploit fear, that we're never going to go back to a more rational, fairer, and genuinely accurate view of Muslims in America? Has this been lost?
No, I mean, I think, you know, I think there's all kinds of groups around the United States who are trying to introduce the Muslim American community to the rest of American society and kind of tell those stories. And I think those kinds of initiatives are really important and have the potential to be successful.
Arun Kundani, you write in The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror about a number of cases in which the FBI has in fact created the terrorists, created the facts, and then prosecuted the case, and in some instances achieved very long prison sentences for crimes that the FBI created. Is this a fair representation of what Homeland Security is doing, or are these cases outliers in your judgment?
No, this is the textbook approach. This is not these aren't the exceptions. The exceptions are the kind of handful of cases at most where there does seem to have been a real plot. Obviously, there's the Boston Marathon bombing last year, and then there's the Najibullah Zazi case in New York a while back. But you know, you can count those actual real plots, on one hand, and then you have every 2 months a plot which would not have existed were it not for an infiltration sting operation by the FBI.
I think some listeners would say, I understand that there is this huge amount of surveillance going on and wiretapping and infiltration of groups and agent provocateurs and all of that done by Homeland Security and the FBI. I got that. But it's justified, they would argue, because the results of this extremism, of this kind of military operations in the United States, are so immense. 9/11, of course, being the most obvious example, but the Boston Marathon bombing being, and I'm not a close second, but a close second.
Right, right. And part of the problem we have at the moment is that we've widened our definition of what we want to be investigating as a terrorist threat. So we're no longer just focusing on actual threats of mass violence, but we're focusing on some vaguer notion of ideology. And so in doing so, that means we're collecting huge amounts of information about what people's religious views are, about what their political views are. And that actually in practice gets in the way of a tighter focus on actual active plots. And so one of the things you'll notice is that in most cases, when there is a successful terrorist case, when there's a successful terrorist plot, all the information is somewhere in the government's databases. It's just its meaning has been lost amidst this kind of morass of useless data that's being collected. So actually, even from a purely pragmatic point of view, forget the civil rights issues, we'd be better off with a much narrower focus, not talking about ideology so much, but just looking at who's actively preparing a terrorist plot, who's inciting terrorism, who's financing terrorism, that kind of bread and butter law enforcement kind of work.
At the ACLU, we have this image that we use often to say that the way to catch a terrorist is to use human intelligence, and that it's very difficult to catch a terrorist. It's really like finding a needle in a haystack. And so our government, its infinite wisdom, in order to find the needle in the haystack, has decided to make the haystack a million times larger.
Absolutely. That's a great way of putting it. There's some other things that we could do if we're serious about tackling terrorism. I mean, one of the things to think about is, one of the tactics that terrorists have used over the last few years is a group of guys getting a fairly powerful automatic weapon and opening fire in a shopping mall, like in Kenya last year, or like in Mumbai a few years ago. Making it harder to get hold of high power automatic weapons would be a great thing to do to reduce that risk. And then the kind of biggest factor here is understanding what really causes terrorism is not religious ideology, but political conflicts. And so thinking about the role of American foreign policy in creating political contexts within which terrorism becomes more likely is actually the biggest thing that we can be doing here.
When we come back, we're going to talk further with Arun Kunani. He will be at Hampshire College at Franklin Patterson Hall today at noon. We're going to ask about the United States' use of violence and its influence on terrorism. We'll be right back.
This is Bill Newman, WHMP.
Eating locally grown food during wintertime in New England used to be a challenge. Not any longer. When you shop at Greenfield's Market and McCusker's Market, you'll find delicious locally grown apples, organic potatoes, carrots, and greens, fresh local milk, yogurt, and cheese. Our co-op bakery uses locally grown four-star farms wheat in a variety of delectable breads. Fresh, local, organic, and easy all year long. Greenfield's Market in Greenfield and McCusker's Market in Shelburne Falls. Building our local community, one delicious meal at a time.
Don's a smart guy. He can also be demanding. I should know. Don's had his insurance with Whalen Insurance for as long as I can remember. When Don needs something, he calls or just comes into the office on King Street. He usually talks to Kelly, though sometimes he talks to Becky. But the last time Don came in, he wanted to talk to me. He said, "You know, I can get a better deal at Costco." I couldn't believe it. I wanted to say, "Great, Don. Why don't you pick up a 30-pack of paper towels and an insurance policy next time you're there?" Instead, I said, "Don, first of all, thanks for choosing Whalen Insurance all these years. You expect a lot. But service is our business. If you do decide to try Costco, I'll be curious. After you enter your policy number on the dial pad, let me know if you ever talk to the same person twice. Please call us for your next insurance quote. Whalen Insurance. Local people, local service, local insurance. In partnership with Arbella Insurance. Call 586-1000.
How would you like to earn $15,000 for doing nothing? Nothing except helping to save the planet? Install a solar power system from Northeast Solar at your home. Your solar power system produces electricity, which earns solar renewable energy credits that you can sell to non-clean energy producers. A typical residential PV system will earn $1,500 in energy credit income per year. After 10 years, $15,000. Call Northeast Solar, Hatfield, northeast-solar.com.
Before you go out to eat, go to WHMP.com. Shop Save 30. Buy full value restaurant gift certificates for 30% off. Just click, print, and save 30%. Now go out to eat. Save 30% even faster with print on demand. Just print and eat. Shop Save 30 at WHMP.com.
Revelry. Boisterous festivity.
Sentence, please.
Don't miss the Revelry, also known as the Northampton Education Foundation Adult Spelling Bee, Wednesday, March 26, 6 p.m. at JFK Middle School.
R-E-V-E-L-R-Y?
Prizes awarded for spelling, costume, and humor. For more information, go to northampton-edfoundation.org, supported by East Hampton Savings Bank.
And don't miss WHMP's live broadcast of the Adult Spelling Bee, Wednesday, March 26th.
This is Bill Newman, WHMP.
We continue our conversation with Arun Kunani. He is the author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. He was at UMass last night. He'll be at Hampshire College at Franklin Patterson Hall at noon today. There's a part in your book that, there are actually two parts that are related that I'd love to talk to you about. One has to do with the tradition of Muslims in America. And I think a lot of people, when they look back and they say, I remember Muhammad Ali saying, "I am a Muslim," and saying, are we talking about the same Muslims as Muhammad Ali? And are we talking about that belief system, or is this something new and different?
Right. You know, about a third of American Muslims are African Americans. And so that strand of Muslim American history is kind of often neglected, but it's incredibly important. The different kinds of interpretation of Islam within the African American community have kind of varied over time. Obviously, the Nation of Islam is famous from the 60s onwards. That was what Muhammad Ali was involved in. But nowadays, you know, African American Islam is very much more closer to what gets called Orthodox Islam. And so, you know, There are multiple strands within the American Muslim community, just like any religion, different interpretations. These kind of African-American strands are just one among many.
In the 1960s and 70s, the United States government, with its COINTELPRO program, worked very hard to destroy political dissidents and dissidents. Do you believe that the United States government, by targeting Muslims and in particular mosques, is trying to undermine Islam in the United States?
I think it's not so much about trying to undermine Islam. It's about trying to depoliticize Islam, right? The American government, I think, has invested quite a lot of resources in trying to create a version of Islam that is politically quiet and doesn't have any criticisms of American foreign policy in the Middle East, for example, right?
Does Islam inherently have any more or less of a political bent than any other of the world's major religions?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think how any religion offers you a kind of broad moral framework, and then how you apply that religion in will depend on the context you're in, and the same is true for Islam. So if you have a context where, like the context for most of the 20th century in the Middle East, where all kinds of political injustices have happened, people turn to Islam as a way to try and make sense of that and resist those injustices. Just like liberation theology in Latin America became a way for people there to try and deal with the political challenges they were facing.
You say that about a third of the Muslims in the United States are African American, leaving two-thirds who are not. Is there a division? Are there divisions of race and other cultural factors among the Muslim community in the United States?
There have been divisions, less so than in the past, but certainly for a long time, the kind of new Muslim communities that came, post 1965 from various parts of the world, from the Middle East, from Asia, from Africa, tended to not develop organic relationships with the longer existing African-American Muslim community here. But there's various initiatives to try and kind of break down those divisions nowadays.
And is there a division between Sunnis and other sects, Muslim sects in the United States, that is as prevalent and as intense as in other parts of the world?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, occasionally, you might get disagreements over, that are a reflection of some of the disagreements in the Middle East. It's not really about a religious disagreement between Sunni and Shia, but more to do with the political differences. There's a kind of mini Cold War going on in the Middle East between Saudi Arabia and Iran. So it's sometimes that gets drawn into some kind of disagreements here.
Following up on that aspect of your book, there is a section titled From Anti-Semitism to Islamophobia. Would you explain what you tried or what you do say in that section? I thought it was really interesting.
So, we know that in the history of anti-Semitism, a group of people who share a religion have been racialized, right? They've been turned into a race and viewed through that lens. And one of the things that was central to that, particularly in the first half of the 20th century, is a conspiracy theory that said Jews are secretly controlling the world and they're to blame for everything that goes wrong. And that leads to the Nazi regime, and ultimately it's culminates in the Holocaust. And what I find interesting is that we're doing something similar now with how we think about Muslims. So we've racialized Muslims into thinking of them as a race, and we see the same kinds of conspiracy theories. What I call the Sharia conspiracy theory is an idea that, Obama is secretly a Muslim, Muslims are secretly running the administration, there's this kind of nefarious secret plot to take over the West and impose Sharia law, and that's a recurring theme, on the right of American politics. Occasionally, it pops up, even with with people in elected office in Washington. So that seems to me very reminiscent of exactly the same kind of Jewish conspiracy theories that we would have seen 100 years ago.
I'd like to go back, if I might, to this question about FBI and Homeland Security infiltration of Muslim communities, because it seems to me that over history, and the history of law enforcement, that what you find that the best intelligence is human intelligence. All you can do all the surveilling you want in the world, but at the end of the day, it's some human being coming to some law enforcement person saying, I heard this, I know this, I suspect this. And that's what really breaks conspiracies and what breaks down plots as well. And it seems to me that Homeland Security is actually making us less secure, significantly less secure, by trying to infiltrate mosques and creating agent provocateurs, because there's this enormous distrust, I'm told, and I'd love your opinion on this and your perspective, because there's this enormous distrust that the government has fostered and created between exactly the people and the groups that it wants to be working with.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think ultimately security is best secured by relationships of trust and strong communities, not creating a climate of fear and suspicion. And you're right, human intelligence is like of far more use than what security officials call signals intelligence, this kind of NSA data collection. What I would add is when we think about human intelligence, we need to also have a very clear definition of what we think is a crime, right? And part of the problem we have at the moment is we've widened the definition of what we want to be considering a crime so widely that things that before 9/11 would have been seen as First Amendment protected activity, things that people say, their beliefs, are now kind of slipping into the category of material support for terrorism and therefore, serious
punishable
crimes.
By life in prison.
Absolutely.
I'd like to conclude, if I might, by asking you about a part of your book, Arun Kundnani, about in which you talk about the focusing of the intelligence community on Muslims. And you say this in Britain, and then you go on to say how it has jumped over the pond, as they like to say, and you like to say in Britain. In Britain, the new thinking on radicalization that emerged in national security circles beginning in 2004 became the basis for one of the most elaborate programs of surveillance and social control attempted in a Western state in recent decades. You also mentioned here this morning Orwell. And in 1984, what Orwell points out is there's always an enemy of the state, but it changes. What the state needs is an enemy. And I'm wondering if you have some sense that this focusing on Islam and Muslims as the other, the enemy, the people who need to be different in the United States and Britain, whether that will at some point run its course and, well, I guess we'll find some other enemy to focus on.
Right. I mean, I think, we can look back at history. We can look back at that period after the end of the Cold War when the old enemy, the communists, the Russians, became that was no longer the enemy. And so you can see people writing at that time actively doing the work of trying to say we have a new enemy coming up, and it's going to be the Muslims, it's going to be Islam, right? And so, you know, if we get a new geopolitical situation at some point in the future, you can imagine the same thing would happen. But you know, those are always political openings where it's up to us, I think, as people who don't want to live in a world where we're constantly in fear, to say, maybe we can work out a way of making our societies work without having to have this kind of constant enemy in our midst. And so we don't want to be living in a society that looks a little bit like Orwell's 1984.
Arun Kundnani, you have as your title, The Muslims Are Coming. You take it and you discuss at some point the movie The Russians Are Coming. Why?
Well, The Russians Are Coming is an interesting film because it comes out of a kind of 60s critique of the Cold War, right? And it's kind of mocking very extreme kind of anti-communism of that period. But
can you give us a plot summary in 15 seconds?
Sure. So this is a film about a Russian submarine that accidentally runs aground on an island off the coast of Maine, I think, and the Russian sailors kind of disembark and try and get some parts they need to repair their submarine, and the island thinks that it's the Third World War and
they're
Russians
being invaded.
Are invading, right? The Russians are coming, and eventually, the final standoff is a situation where there's a little kid who's trying to who's hanging off a church steeple, and the Russian sailors and the American kind of militia get together and save him, and kind of world harmony ensues, right, in this kind of happy Hollywood ending. But I found a lot of parallels in that film in terms of how we can think about what's happening now. And the key thing that you notice in the film is that the Russians never talk about their politics. They never come across as communists, and that makes it possible for this kind of reconciliation. So, you know, for me, the key point that we're facing is the only way in which Muslims can be tolerated is if they depoliticize and don't express their political opinions.
Arun Khanani, his new book is The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terrorism, on Terror. He will be at Franklin Patterson Hall at Hampshire College today at noon, and his book is available online. We won't tell you that, but it is also available at your local independent bookstore. Order it. It's a really interesting and important book. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much.
We'll be right back.
Get in on the conversation. Call 413-586-7140. This is Bill Newman, WHMP.
Feel like breakfast for lunch? Or how about lunch for lunch?